mirror symmetry for final surfaces.
Okay, thank you. So this is a talk about joint work with Ludmil Kazakov and Dima Orlov. But I should say that it's just a feeble mathematician's attempt at verifying ideas that fit into a bigger picture. And in particular, so what I will talk about follows ideas of Kontsevich, Seidel, Kentaro-Hori, Buffer, and many other people. So let me start by reminding you that, generally speaking, mirror symmetry predicts the correspondence between complex and symplectic manifolds at various levels. And in particular, we are going to be looking at the geometry of suitable cycles, well, brains, physicists call them, in these two situations. So in complex manifolds, we want to look at complex analytic cycles equipped with holomorphic vector bundles on them. Or even better, well, green is not very readable, I'm sorry. Even better, coherent sheaves on them. And then we can do intersection theory on these things, which essentially amounts to looking at morphisms and extensions of sheaves. On the side of symplectic manifolds, we want to look at Lagrangian submanifolds. So that means submanifolds of half a dimension on which the restriction of the symplectic form vanishes. And we want to equip them additionally with flat unitary bundles. But I will not insist on that side because I will be looking mostly at simply connected Lagrangians. Now, intersection theory in this case ends up featuring corrections coming from pseudo-holomorphic curves with boundaries in the Lagrangian. And that gives rise to the theory of Fleur homology. And essentially, in a naive view, this amounts to discarding intersection points that can be canceled by Hamiltonian isotopies. So the prediction of mirror symmetry, and in particular the homological mirror symmetry conjecture of Kontsevich, is that at least at the level of derived categories. So that means if we introduce a sufficient amount of algebraic formalism, homological algebra, to somehow make up for our shortcomings in the geometric understanding, well, brains in 2A string theory should correspond to Lagrangian submanifolds plus flat bundles. And brains in the B model should correspond to coherent sheaves, and so derived categories on both sides should be equivalent. So in particular, for the Calabi-Yau case, the prediction of the homological mirror symmetry conjecture is that for a mirror pair, the derived category of coherent sheaves on one Calabi-Yau should be equivalent to the derived Fukuyama category of its mirror, and vice versa. So let me just remind you quickly, if we have a complex manifold, we can look at a category of coherent sheaves with morphisms given by, well, morphisms of sheaves, but also extensions. And then we can build the bounded derived category, which is a category whose objects are complexes, bounded complexes, consisting of sheaves and morphisms in between, and compositions should be zero. And then morphisms are morphisms of complexes, but up to some homological algebra. So in particular, up to homotopy and up to localizing with respect to quasi-isomorphisms, which means that if you have a morphism of complexes, which induces an isomorphism on the cohomology of the complexes, then you want to say that actually it is invertible. Now, on the symplectic side, we have the mythical Fukuyama A infinity category, which is, roughly speaking, a category whose objects should be Lagrangian submanifolds. Well, some of them at least, there are conditions about being relatively spin and things like that. Should be Lagrangian submanifolds essentially for which Fleur theory is well defined and non-trivial, equipped with flat unitary bundles over them. And again, I'm going to forget about the flat bundles because they will be trivial in my case. Morphisms between Lagrangians should correspond to their intersections. So we have this notion of a Fleur complex, which at least for Lagrangians that intersect transversely is just a free vector space generated by with generators corresponding to the intersection points. And this thing has a grading by something called the Maslow index, which I will not define. So now this is an A-infinity category, which means that it carries various structures. In particular, there is a differential, D, sometimes called M1, on each morphism space. Then there's a product, which stands for the composition of morphisms. And this composition is only associative up to homotopy. And there are higher products, which multiply more than two morphisms at once, which encode actually this defect of associativity into something called the A-infinity equations. So I'm just skipping quickly over the details because the examples I will look at essentially will be much simpler than this general setup. But just to give you a quick idea, so the differential in the Fourier category is just the Fleur differential on the Fleur complex of two Lagrangian submanifolds. So namely, it acts on the vector space whose generators correspond to intersection points. And the coefficients correspond to a certain count of pseudo-holomorphic curves, pseudo-holomorphic disks with boundary in the two Lagrangians. So namely, one fixes almost complex structures chosen generically. And well, at least in the naive version, actually, one has to refine things. Essentially, well, I guess Kenji in his talk this morning explained things in a much more rigorous manner. But naively, at least, one wants to count pseudo-holomorphic maps from the disk with two marked points on the boundary to the given symplectic manifold, mapping the boundaries to the given Lagrangian submanifolds and the two marked points to fixed intersection points. And one counts these with a coefficient which is essentially related, it's exponential of minus the symplectic area of the disk. And I want to point out that if you don't want to think about pseudo-holomorphic maps, because I will be working mostly with Riemann surfaces, well, if I'm on a Riemann surface, then this is the same thing as counting immersed disks with convex corners. So it becomes a combinatorial count of polygonal regions on my Riemann surface. Now, the product proceeds essentially in the same way. Now, if we have a morphism from L0 to L1, that's an intersection point, or a combination of these. One from L1 to L2, that's again an intersection point. And we want to compose them to obtain a combination, a linear combination of intersections between L0 and L2. And the coefficients in this linear combination are obtained by counting pseudo-holomorphic disks with boundary on the three given Lagrangian submanifolds and with corners at the prescribed intersection points. And same story for the higher products. These work by considering now K morphisms. And well, you multiply all of them by counting pseudo-holomorphic maps which map to polygonal regions with boundary in the considered configuration of Lagrangian submanifolds. So that was the classical Calabi-Yau case. Now, what happens if we are instead dealing with Fano manifolds? So if I look at a Fano variety, so something with first term class positive, then I might not be able to find a mirror partner that is the variety itself, but at least I can find a mirror that is a Landau-Ginzburg model. And for me, as a mathematician, that just means a non-compact manifold equipped with a complex-valued function called superpotential. And then mirror symmetry tells us that the symplectic of a complex geometry of X should be related to the complex or symplectic geometry of not quite this manifold y, but instead of a critical point of the superpotential. So the mirror conjecture, the homological mirror conjecture in this case, predicts that the derived category of coherent sheaves on X should be equivalent to a derived category made out of the Lagrangian vanishing cycles of the superpotential, and that the Fourier category of X should correspond to a category built out of the complex geometry of the singularities, and which can be related to matrix model matrix factorizations. So I'm going to focus only on the first half of this statement. Namely, I'm going to try to show you in examples how the derived category of coherent sheaves on a Fano can be often related to a certain category of Lagrangian vanishing cycles on the mirror superpotential. So more precisely, this category D lag of W has been defined rigorously by mathematicians only in one case so far, namely under the assumption that the critical points of W are isolated and non-degenerate. So if you prefer, W is a complex Morse function. So in that case, I've tried to draw a picture of what the singularities look like. So the singular fibers of the superpotential are nodal. Well, they have ordinary double point singularities, and they are obtained from the generic smooth fiber by contracting a vanishing cycle, which essentially is just a sphere of half a dimension. So now, if you're trying this in algebraic geometry, you might think of vanishing cycle as just being something in cohomology or in homology, and viewing the monotomy on the level of its action on the homology of a fiber. But if you're a symplectic geometer, then you can actually give to this vanishing cycle a concrete incarnation as a Lagrangian submanifold. And the way you can do that is by choosing an arc in the base, in C, joining a reference regular value, let's call that lambda zero, joining it to your critical value by a certain arc in the base. And now, on the fibration, we have a notion of symplectic parallel transport, namely just at every point outside of a singular point, we take the symplectic orthogonal to the fiber. If I take the symplectic orthogonal to the fiber, that gives me a horizontal distribution, and parallel transport is by symplectomorphisms between the fibers. Now, if I look at the set of points which collapse to the singularity as I do parallel transport along my given arc, then I will obtain my vanishing cycle realized as a Lagrangian sphere inside the fiber. So the parallel transport, so again, if I choose an arc in the base, I can define parallel transport along that arc, and it will give me a map from one fiber to another fiber. And it is a symplectomorphism, except, of course, along the, I mean, except if I get all the way to the singular fiber, then it collapses the vanishing cycle. So now if I have several critical points and several critical values, then I can choose a collection of arcs, joining them to my reference fiber, and I can build my list of vanishing cycles associated to this collection of arcs. And so let's choose an ordered such collection that's ordered clockwise around my reference fiber. You see here, gamma 1 to gamma r are ordered clockwise around the given fiber. Then there's a construction due to Seidel, which builds a finite directed A infinity category out of such a setup. And so that's essentially a toy model for the Fourier category that we want to look at, or the category of vanishing cycles. It's a toy model, and it's also a finite generating set. So actually, it will be an exceptional collection that generates the derived category, which will be something much larger and much harder to understand explicitly. But essentially, we're going to be in the world of nice, well-behaved categories which admit so-called exceptional collections, which essentially is the analog for a category of having a finite presentation for a group, for example. So what are the objects of this infinity category? Well, there will just be one object for each vanishing cycle. So actually, at this point, I should give you a word of warning that I'm going to define these objects as being the vanishing cycles. But actually, what they stand for, more precisely, is the so-called thimbles associated to the arcs gamma I. Namely, if I look not only at my vanishing cycle, but at its trace as it is transported above the arc gamma, then I obtain actually a disk or a ball whose boundary is the vanishing cycle and whose center is the critical point. And this is going to be, again, a Lagrangian disk. And although I'm disguising it by speaking only of the vanishing cycles and the fiber, what's going on here is actually Fleur theory for these thimbles. So that in particular motivates a slightly funny notion of morphisms in that category, namely morphisms from Li to Lj, from the I vanishing cycle to the J vanishing cycle. Well, what you might expect, namely the Fleur complex counting intersections between them, in the case where I is less than J. So if I go from something that is somewhere in my collection to something that is further in the collection. However, if I am in the opposite situation where I is greater than J, then I set up the definition so that there are no morphisms. Morphism space is zero. And so in a sense, this is like half of the Fleur theory associated to specifically these Lagrangian submanifolds of the fiber. So more precisely, when I try to compose morphisms in this category, well, all compositions will have to go essentially in a manner compatible with the ordering of the vanishing cycles, because otherwise I have no interesting morphisms. And in that case, and in that case only, the composition is obtained by the same construction that I explained before, but only inside the fiber. So actually, you can already see that for feeble-minded mathematicians like me, this is much easier to deal with than the Calabi-Yau case, because I have one, essentially one dimension just by being able to restrict to the fiber. I have also avoided the embarrassing question of deciding how many Lagrangians there are inside my fiber. I only have to look at the vanishing cycles. So, I mean, homological mirror symmetry is interesting for Fano varieties, but it's also easier to check in that sense, because the mirrors will have much simpler looking Fourier categories. Okay, the other word of technical advice here, well, I mean, whenever one does Fleur homology, one has to be careful about bubbling and all sorts of catastrophic things that could happen. Well, in this case, I'm only going to look at situations where my fibers are Riemann surfaces of genus at least one, and my Lagrangians will be non-homotopically trivial closed loops. So that essentially eliminates all possible causes of bubbling. So as I told you, what we obtain here is actually only a set of generators for a much larger category. We're only looking at our very specific non-compact Lagrangian submanifolds, which are these thimbles associated to the choice of arcs. If we choose different arcs, then we will get very different thimbles, and that will completely mess up what we are looking at. Things will look very different because the new vanishing cycles, if I switch to a different arc, will be conjugated by the monodromy, and their ordering will change. However, what Seidel has shown is that changing the collection of arcs affects this construction by an operation called mutation. And mutation essentially means that you're replacing you're exchanging two of your objects, replacing one by actually a twist. It's image under a twist along the other one. So it's a purely, well, homological algebra construction. But the end result is that the derived category, well, defining derived in a suitable way, depends only on the symplectic geometry of this mirror. So it depends on the manifold Y, its symplectic form, and the superpotential. Yes. It probably doesn't. I'm not going to go too far in that direction, but indeed, I believe it doesn't have to be holomorphic as long as all the fibers are symplectic submanifolds. Unfortunately, the fact that the fibers are symplectic still tells you that it must be topologically conjugate to something holomorphic. So if you want, losing holomorphicity just means that actually you have a deformation of a complex structure on Y, maybe to an almost complex structure. So, I mean, essentially there exists an almost complex structure on Y compatible with a symplectic form for which it's holomorphic or pseudo-holomorphic. So, I mean, not much is happening there. Okay, so now my goal is to try to illustrate that on a couple of examples. So the first example I will look at is that of weighted projective planes. And I should say that extends actually previous work of various other people, in particular, well, when Seidel made his definition, he immediately checked what happens for the mirror to P2, CP2, and, well, essentially things do work in that case. So, okay, so what's the example? We look at the manifold called, I will call CP2 of ABC. That means I choose a triple of positive integers A, B, and C. You can think of them as being mutually prime. That makes things slightly easier. And then you look, well, at least as an orbifold, it's just the quotient of C3 minus the origin by an action of C star, which is not the usual diagonal action, but instead has weights A, B, and C. So if you take A equals B equals C equals 1, you get the usual CP2. And in general, you get a Fano orbifold, or actually a stack. And now you might know that in the case of CP2, the derived category of coherent sheaves is generated by O, O of 1, and O of 2. So at the derived level, I can build any sheaf over CP2 out of O, O of 1, and O of 2 by taking complexes and doing all sorts of, well, just by doing what you do in the derived category. So in the case of weighted projective spaces, I have to take more generators. I have to look at O, O of 1, and so on up to O of n minus 1, where n is the sum of the weights. And what these things are, well, O of j is the sheaf whose sections over something that comes from a piece of C3 are holomorphic functions which transform with weight j under the toric action, sorry, under the C star action. So in particular, the homogeneous coordinates x, y, and z, well, on CP2, they are sections of O of 1. On a weighted projective space, they are sections of O of A, O of B, O of C. And for example, if A, B, and C are all greater than 1, then O of 1 has no global holomorphic sections. So with this definition, it should be rather clear that morphisms from O of I to O of J will essentially correspond to weighted homogeneous polynomials of degree j minus I. So what we have, yes, I'm assuming that A, B, and C are positive. So in that case, actually, these O of I, I mean, these O, O of 1, and so on up to O of n minus 1 will again behave like an exceptional collection generating the derived category. And what does the mirror look like? Well, the mirror, because these are toric orbifolds, the mirrors are just predicted. They fall naturally in this toric framework. And what toric geometry says is that the mirror is going to be a hypersurface in C star cubed, namely the hypersurface defined by the equation x to the a, y to the b times z to the c equals 1. Well, actually, there's some deformation parameter there, but it doesn't matter for the symplectic side. And the corresponding superpotential will just be the sum of the coordinates x plus y plus z. Note, by the way, that topologically, this mirror is actually a complex two-dimensional torus, C star squared, if A, B, and C are mutually prime. So now we can try to understand how this thing behaves. And things are easiest if we realize that we have a cyclic group acting on this mirror, namely Z mod N acts by diagonal multiplication. And we also have complex conjugation. So if we exploit this symmetry, it becomes much easier to actually figure out what the vanishing cycles look like, how they intersect, and what are the pseudo-holomorphic disks joining them. So to do that, we need to choose a symplectic form, which is also invariant under these group actions and under complex conjugation. And that automatically implies exactness. That implies that the symplectic form is D of some one form. So now if we do that, we can do computations. And the theorem that we get is that the derived categories of Lagrangian vanishing cycles for this superpotential and of coherent sheaves on the weighted projective plane are equivalent. And actually, it's slightly stronger than that. I mean, to prove equivalence between these categories, what one does is actually one exhibits generating exceptional collections on both sides and shows that the objects correspond to each other in the sense that they have the same morphisms and that the composition laws for morphisms are the same on both sides. So it's really like proving that two groups are isomorphic by getting the same presentation for both of them. Now, this story should actually extend to weighted projective spaces in all dimensions. But we cannot quite claim that we have proved it because in higher dimensions, so I mean, all of this generalizes naturally, the mirror becomes essentially, again, a hypersurface, the obvious one in C star to the n plus one. And well, one can understand what the vanishing cycles look like, but it becomes harder to check. I mean, at least I'm personally unable to check that the pseudo-holomorphic disks that I can see between the intersection points are regular and are the only ones. So I cannot prove that Fleur theory is indeed what I want it to be. But still, it seems like things will work exactly in the same way. Now, if we look more carefully at what happens, so mirror symmetry should be not only about pairs of manifolds, but also about families. And when we have a complex manifold, we have complex deformations given by H1 of a tension bundle. When we have a symplectic manifold, we have symplectic deformations given by changing the cohomology class of a symplectic form. So in our situation, things are slightly skewed because X is a rigid Fano. It has no complex deformations. While on the other hand, Y is topologically a complex torus, so it has a one-dimensional H2. So we could actually deform the symplectic structure to a non-exact one. And we could also, at the same time, introduce a B field, which is just the complexification of a symplectic form. So let's say that we choose a parameter, T, among complex numbers, and we deform the symplectic form and the B field so that when we integrate this over the generator of a second homology, so the generator of a second homology here is very easy to see. It's a torus which corresponds to setting the norms of X, Y, and Z all equal to one. It's the unit circle in each vector. And if we set our cohomology classes so that the integral over this torus is equal to T, then we obtain a deformed category of vanishing cycles. How is it deformed? Well, we don't change the topology of the fibration because it's still the same function on the same manifold, but what we change is the notion of parallel transport. So our vanishing cycles will still be in the same homotopy classes, but they will lie in slightly shifted positions inside the fiber. And that will affect the areas of pseudoholomorphic curves between them. Sometimes could also create pairs of intersections, but that's not actually relevant at the homological level. So what does this deformation correspond to? Well, the answer that algebraic geometers like to make is that this corresponds to a non-commutative deformation of the Fano variety stack in this case. And so I should mention actually that there's an interpretation probably in terms of generalized complex structures. But in this case, I mean, the theory has been worked out in much more detail by algebraic geometers. So in the non-commutative framework, well, the idea is essentially coherent sheaves over CP2 or a weighted CP2 correspond to projective modules over an algebra, which in the case of CP2 is just the symmetric algebra with free generators. So now, instead of considering modules of a polynomial algebra, you can deform the polynomial algebra in just a very simple-minded manner. Namely, you make the variables commute only up to some multiplicative factor. So you choose some constants, and you say that now, say, y times z is going to be a constant times zy. And same thing with the others. Now, if you look at the level of the category of modules over this algebra, the parameters mu1, mu2, mu3 themselves are not relevant. The only thing that is relevant is the combination mu1 to the A times mu2 to the B times mu3 to the C. And now if we choose this parameter to be equal to exponential of I times T, the same T that I had up there in my symplectic deformation, then the categories, the deformed categories, will be, again, equivalent. And that is checked again by comparing what happens on explicit generating exceptional collections. Okay, so let me try to give you an idea of the flavor of the calculations that are required to check these things on the symplectic side, on the Landau-Ginzburg model. So that essentially is something that I'm very familiar with these days because I'm teaching multivariable calculus. And that essentially is an advanced exercise in multivariable calculus. Namely, you are given domain, well, this surface, x to the a, y to the b, z to the c equals 1 in c star cubed, and the function, x plus y plus z, and you want to look for its critical points. Well, it turns out you can easily check that the critical points well, there will be n of them, and the corresponding critical values will be the solutions of this funny equation, lambda to the a plus b plus c equals some constant, well, a plus b plus c to the a plus b plus c over a to the a, b to the b, c to the c. And these roots are cyclically ordered around the origin, which essentially is consistent with the observation that we had a cyclic group acting. The cyclic group acts transitively on the critical points. So now to exploit the symmetry, we are going to choose our reference fiber to be the fiber above zero. And here, of course, we are not following what physicists are telling us, because physicists say, actually, you should look at the images of vanishing cycles in a fiber near infinity. And, well, we're going to pay the price for that later in the argument. But at the moment, let's look at the fiber above the origin, and let's just join that fiber to each of the critical fibers using a straight line in the base of the fibration W. Well, if we do that, we will get vanishing cycles, and if we have invariance or equivariance under the cyclic group action, then all these vanishing cycles will be images of each other under the induced cyclic group action on the central fiber. So how do we see that in practice? How do we view the central fiber? So the set of points x, y, z, where x plus y plus z is 0 and x to the a, y to the b, z to the c is 1. Well, the best answer I can give to that is we can project it to one of the coordinate axes. So say we project, for example, to the x variable, I mean, y or z would do just as well, then we realize our fiber as a branched cover of c star, a b plus c fold cover with A plus B plus C branch points. And then we can actually map down our vanishing cycles in this Riemann surface, view them as double lifts of arcs joining branch points. So I've given you pictures for the usual CP2 on the right, or for CP2 with weights 4, 2, 1 on the left. You get these nice pictures, which you can actually learn to view as Riemann surfaces. Just have to think of branch covers of these things. And that lets you get a description of your category of Lagrangian vanishing cycles by just staring for long enough at these pictures, looking, trying to figure out where the vanishing cycles intersect. Well, where they intersect is kind of obvious in the picture, but each time you have to lift to the covering and see whether there is indeed an intersection up there or not. And similarly, when you're looking for pseudo-holomorphic disks, you have to check, well, various possibilities. But so at the end of the day, what you get is that the total number of intersections between our vanishing cycles is actually 3 times n. And there's a nice structure to that. Namely, each vanishing cycle intersects the one that comes A positions further, or B positions further, or C positions further in the sequence. And so the intersections can be labeled naturally. I'm using variables x, y, and z to label the intersection points by analogy with the coordinates, because these are actually essentially, they correspond to the morphisms between O of I, O of J's, and so on, which correspond exactly to the homogeneous coordinates on the corresponding mirror of Fano. Now, so anyway, I have a bunch of morphisms in my category. And for, well, for completeness, I have to actually compute their degrees, because I have a graded, I have a grading by Maslow index. Then I have to compute the differential, the product, and the higher product, and then try to match that with the description of the derived category of coherent sheaves on my weighted projective plane. So okay, the gradings are given here for your information. I mean, of course, since we have shifts, we can shift the objects. That's a slightly arbitrary choice. In terms of compositions, it turns out that we are very lucky. We are going to get an honest category. We have no two-sided disks. We have no polygonal regions with more than 3 sides. All that we have is a bunch of contributions to M2, to the usual product. And more precisely, we have triangles. Well, let me try to show you the triangular regions on this picture. Well, the triangular regions are those you might or might not see. Well, on the right picture, they're rather obvious. There are 3 triangles that are somehow the petals of this flower. And on the left picture, it's essentially the same, except that they are not quite symmetric. So, well, I'm not sure that I can show them very well. Okay, let me just get back there anyway. So we have these compositions just by enumerating all triangular regions. And we get some coefficients which correspond to the symplectic areas of these regions. Now, it turns out that in the case where we have complex conjugation invariants, so if the symplectic form is exact, then these regions essentially come in pairs that are complex conjugate to each other. And so what that implies, but on the other hand, sorry, the induced orientations on the moduli spaces are reversed. So when you have a triangle, a pseudo-holomorphic triangle that counts with a certain coefficient to a composition, then there is a complex conjugate composition where the same triangle, or rather its complex conjugate, will count with the opposite coefficient, with a minus sign. So what we get at the end is a structure that looks a lot like actually an exterior algebra with generators x, y, z in degrees a, b, and c. And if we deform the cohomology class to a non-exact one, then what we will get is actually a deformation of that with a ratio of coefficients related to the cohomology class. So the kind of deformation that I was mentioning. The problem is we have an exterior algebra, while on the other side we had something that looked like a symmetric algebra. So now it's actually well known that there are other generating exceptional collections for the derived category of coherent sheaves. Namely, instead of using O, O of 1, O of 2, and so on, one can use actually, well, sheaves that correspond to polyvector fields. The other way to think about that is that on this symplectic side, we used the wrong collection of arcs by choosing our reference fiber at the origin and choosing radial lines. Instead, we should have chosen our reference fiber for a very large value of a superpotential, and we should have looked at things somehow from infinity instead of from the origin. So now one can work through the sequence of mutations involved in that and see what happens. Well, there's an underlying algebraic formalism called causal duality, which essentially will exchange a generating exceptional collection, an exceptional collection where the morphisms and compositions look like an exterior algebra. The corresponding dual collection will have actually a symmetric algebra. Let me instead now leave this example and go to another one, which is maybe more fresh and maybe also quite interesting, because this one actually is for smooth Fano surfaces. Namely, we can analyze in a similar way what happens if we blow up CP2. So what's nice about blow-ups on the algebraic geometry side is that there is a good understanding of what blowing up does to the derived category of coherent sheaves. So let's look at CP2 blown up in at most 9 points, and we're going to require that these points are somehow in generic position so that the anti-canonical bundle is ample, I guess if we blow up strictly less than 9 points. More generally, actually, we can push things a little bit further, it's enough to actually assume that we have a NEF anti-canonical bundle, numerically effective. So we can afford to have, well, we would like to have ideally only -1 curves, but actually -2 curves are things that we can accommodate as well. So in that case, the derived category of coherent sheaves has an exceptional collection, which essentially is obtained by lifting what we have for CP2 via the pullback, via just the blow-up map, and adding the structure sheaves of the exceptional divisors of the blow-ups. So now, just to avoid having to go to dual collections like before, I'm going to use actually the one which gives me an exterior algebra. So I'm just going to look at O, the trivial line bundle, if you want, then the pullback of the tension bundle of CP2 tensored with O of -1, then the pullback of O of 1, and then the structure sheaves of the exceptional divisors. Then in that case, there's an explicit understanding of what the derived category looks like. These sheaves are enough to generate it. And well, if I just look at the first three of them, I get just exactly the same structure as I did for CP2, namely, I have three morphisms from O to T of -1, and three morphisms from T of -1 to O of 1, and three sections of O of 1. And the composition laws are those actually of the exterior product between, essentially, if you just trivialize things, you have C3, and the other one is the second exterior power of C3. Now, if I go to my new object, well, there are morphisms coming from, so morphisms from O to O of EI, there's only one of them, which essentially you can think of as, well, saying the fact, any holomorphic function on CP2 is constant there. Not sure what I want to say, so, but anyway. And there are two morphisms from T of -1 to these things, and there's one morphism from O of 1. And the composition laws between these morphisms, actually, once you have chosen bases for these three-dimensional spaces up there, the composition laws encode exactly the homogeneous coordinates of the point that you blow up. So that's a correspondence between the algebra level and the geometry level. We can recover where we blew up CP2 from the derived category after having chosen bases, which means essentially that we have fixed, made a choice of gauge, if you want, for the automorphism group of CP2. So, and in the generic case, we have no morphisms between these O of EIs, but if we make infinitely close blow-ups, so if we blow up first one point and then blow up a point on the exceptional divisor, then we will create new morphisms because the proper transform of the first exceptional curve will become a minus two curve. And that minus two curve will be a spherical object in the derived category, which is obtained actually as a cone of a morphism between the two objects I'm giving you here. So the category changes depending on where we blow up. Now, how do we get the mirror to this? Well, the mirror to CP2, remember, was just the surface XYZ equals 1 inside C star cubed with superpotential X plus Y plus Z. Well, there I was actually telling you a white lie because physics tells us that we should not just look at these affine parts, but we should actually compactify fiber-wise. We want actually to look at a situation where the fibers of our superpotential are compact Calabi-Yau's. And in the previous example I was discussing, that was not important because I was in the toric world, and somehow it seems like in the toric case, we don't have to bother with compactification. The predictions of mirror symmetry seem to work on the nose without compactifying. In this situation, because I'm going to look sometimes at non-toric mirrors, if I blow up more than 3 points, I have to look at non-toric situations, I have to worry a bit about compactification. But actually, if I compactify not only in the fiber-wise directions, but brutally all over the place, I can try to compactify my hypersurface to a cubic surface inside CP3, given by homogeneous equation XYZ equals T cubed. Well, that thing is actually singular. So if I resolve it, I'm going to obtain something more interesting. And if I restrict just to the finite part, to where my superpotential takes finite values, so when I compactify, W extends to a meromorphic function, takes values in C union infinity, and I should restrict myself to the finite part. I should throw away the fiber above infinity. And then I get an elliptic fibration with three singular fibers, which essentially follows the pattern that I was discussing before, except the fibers are compactified. So, and now the fiber at infinity, well, you probably know that elliptic fibrations over the sphere have to have numbers of singularities, multiple of 12. And indeed, in this case, the compactification divisor is actually a fiber with 9 components. It's just a cycle of 9 rational curves. So what happens when we blow up CP2? Well, when we blow up CP2, you can think of that as somehow switching, turning on the symplectic area of exceptional curves. So you're doing somehow a symplectic deformation, which, well, actually changes the topology, but mostly it's a deformation of a symplectic class on something that virtually contained exceptional curves, but of size 0. And what that does to the mirror is a complex deformation. When we do this complex deformation, our elliptic fibration loses its very singular fiber with 9 components and deforms it to a less singular fiber above infinity plus some isolated singular fibers which come into the finite part. So what we get after deformation is that if we do k blowups, what corresponds to that is a complex deformation that brings k of the 9 critical points at infinity into the finite part. So now we get a new meromorphic function still on the same manifold but with a different complex structure. And if I throw away what corresponds to the pole, the divisor of poles of my superpotential, then I obtain an elliptic fibration with k plus 3 singular fibers, 3 coming from CP2 and k coming from what was initially above infinity. And I can use that to compute things again. So now the claim is that if I choose suitably my symplectic structure on this manifold, then I can recover, indeed, a derived category of vanishing cycles, which will match exactly with the category of coherent sheaves on the blown-up CP2. And here, you see, so on the complex side, we have deformation parameters, at least if we blow up more than a few points, if we start blowing up enough points, then we have parameters which correspond to the coordinates of the blown-up points. On the symplectic side, the only things we can emulate that with is actually the cohomology class of the symplectic form. And, well, things work well because H2 of this manifold MK that I get from throwing away the complexification divisor is indeed, what is it, K plus 2. K plus 3, something like that. Not sure. OK, so how do we view the correspondence between a given choice of a symplectic form on this mirror and a choice of positions of points to blow up on our CP2? And incidentally, how do we view also non-commutative deformations and all sorts of funny things to do in this situation? Well, so to give a concrete meaning to the symplectic deformation parameters, we have to choose homology classes and representatives of them in MK in our mirror, in the total space of our mirror. And then we have to evaluate the symplectic form on those and try to give to that an interpretation in terms of composition laws in the derived category of vanishing cycles and see on the complex side what is the complex interpretation of these deformation parameters for the category of coherent sheaves. So up here you have a picture of the fiber. It's an elliptic curve. So I'm just viewing it as a torus and it's playing opposite sides. And in there, I will have K plus 3 vanishing cycles. The first 3 drawn in black with dotted lines and so on are those which come from the situation of CP2 after fiber was complexification. So you can indeed check that any two of them intersect in 3 points, which fits with the fact that we have 3 morphisms between any two of our 3 generating objects. Now, if we try to understand what freedom we have in setting up the category of vanishing cycles and Fleur theory, well, we have 2 deformation parameters already at that level before we start adding in the extra vanishing cycles. One of them, which I didn't tell you about before in the first example because we didn't complexify the fiber, now that we have a compact fiber, well, that fiber has an area. It has a symplectic area. And well, let me call tau the symplectic area of a fiber, actually 1 over 2 pi. And well, what we should think of when we view this area is actually the moduli parameter of a cubic inside the CP2 that we started with. So a cubic which is essentially, which has moduli parameter tau, and which we realize as a curve inside CP2. Now, what the significance of this cubic is, if you're thinking of a usual CP2 and its usual blowups, is probably not clear. But non-commutative deformations of CP2 are actually parameterized by a cubic curve and an element of peak zero of that cubic curve, or if you prefer, difference between 2 degree free line bundles. Yes. So no, this picture is actually the fiber of the Landau-Ginzburg model. And the area, yes, indeed, so this elliptic curve, if you want, is the mirror of the elliptic curve in CP2, because its area corresponds to the modulus parameter, moduli parameter of an elliptic curve that sits inside CP2. So if you want, if I look at a deformation of CP2, so Poisson deformations can be done by Poisson by vectors. And so now if I look at a Poisson by vector, it will be a holomorphic section of the second exterior power of the tangent bundle of CP2, which is the same thing as O of 3. So that deformation will actually be, well, that Poisson bivector will vanish along a cubic. Or if you prefer, in the language of generalized complex structures, we are doing a generalized complex deformation of the complex structure of CP2, and that generalized deformation actually vanishes along a cubic curve. So why this is relevant is because on a non-commutative P2, well, you actually have much fewer points. Instead of having points everywhere, the set of points that remain commutative but still make sense, which have associated, for example, skyscraper sheaves and so on, are exactly the points on that cubic curve. So in particular, for the theory to make sense, if you want for a non-commutative del Pezzo surface, one must blow up points on the elliptic curve. And well, also, if you want to be able to deal in this formalism with a nine-point blow-up of CP2, then actually the 9 points must lie on the same elliptic curve. For less than 9 points, that's not a constraint. But really, there's an underlying elliptic curve in CP2 where all the blow-ups are being done. So that's what the area of the fiber is related to. Now, again, at that level for CP2, we have another parameter, which is the area of a cycle in the total space whose trace inside the fiber is this thing I've drawn with yellow and blue triangles. These yellow and blue triangles together form a two-chain with boundary in equal to the sum of the free vanishing cycles. And I can recover that in terms, I mean, the area of this thing is related exactly to these parameters mu and alpha that I was talking about in the previous setup. I can recover that from the composition laws in the Fleur theory. So what I have here is a parameter, which is the area of this two chain, and that corresponds actually to the choice of an element in the Picard group of the elliptic curve. Why is that? Well, a while ago, I was telling you this parameter lives in C. It's a complex number. But actually, if I add an integer class to my B field, then nothing happens because I'm just, well, I'm just doing exactly the same theory again. So already I have to quotient by Z. Moreover, well, what this parameter tells me about actually is the relative positions of my free vanishing cycles, whether this star is regular like this or whether it's kind of skewed towards one side. If I skew it so much that the amount of skewing is equal to the area of a fiber, then actually I end up with the same vanishing cycle again. So the theory becomes the same again. So this parameter naturally lives actually in C mod Z plus tau Z. And we didn't see this tau Z because in the previous case, before compactifying, fibers had infinite volume, tau was infinite. Now, when we blow up, we have additional vanishing cycles coming in, and they are all in the same homology class because they all come from a fiber at infinity, which looked like this. So, I mean, these are all in the same homotopy class. But simply, they are not usually Hamiltonian isotopic to each other. So now, each time I have one of my new vanishing cycles, I can play the same trick as I did before with my star and get a new parameter, which will show up somehow in the composition laws. And these parameters, for the same reason, take values, again, in my elliptic curve, because if I add an integer class to the B field, it doesn't matter. And if I also shift the position of my vanishing cycle by something which is the entire area of the fiber, then I go back to the same vanishing cycle. So if you want, these parameters represent the positions of these vanishing cycles. And on the mirror side, they correspond to which points on the elliptic curve I have blown up. And in particular, a really nice phenomenon in this case. So if I compare two of these parameters, the difference between them is the difference in positions of vanishing cycles in this fiber. And so they represent like the area of this shaded pink region is the difference between two of these parameters. That corresponds to the distance between two of my blow-up points. If I bring them back together, if I make the difference between my two parameters become zero, then, or zero mod the elliptic curve, then these two vanishing cycles become Hamiltonian isotopic, and then the Fleur theory changes I actually acquire a pair of intersection points between them. I acquire a pair of morphisms, and a cone over one of these morphisms gives me a spherical object. If you prefer, I acquire a Lagrangian sphere, a genuine compact Lagrangian sphere in there. And that corresponds exactly to the minus two curves that appears when I do infinitely closed blowups. Okay, so that's basically it because I'm out of time, but I just hope that this helped to convince you that homological mirror symmetry is checkable on examples, that it seems to work at least on various examples of Fano surfaces, and that hopefully someday we'll be able to make it work in much greater generality.
Are there any questions?
I don't think it's known actually what the most general ones are, but I mean for CP2, both of them appear here. And I mean I believe that, well, I mean I personally don't know, but I'm not an algebraic geometer. I'm sure that Alexei must have an idea about that. My belief would be that probably it is. Probably that's the entire deformations, but I'm not sure. I mean, that's a question that you should ask to Alexei Bondal, because I'm sure he knows much more than me about these things.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank the speaker again.